The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Welcome to the program. Our guest is Bill Schopoff, Chairman and CEO of Schopoff Realty Investments. Mr. Schopoff has more than 25 years of real estate investment experience, very well known in the industry, and that experience includes the acquisition, development, and sale of new and redeveloped residential and commercial properties. His focus has been on opportunistic and value-added investing, and his specialty for the past 10-plus years has been land investments, and that brings us to our subject, the use of permitting and entitlements to boost the value of undervalued land assets. Bill Schopoff, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Pleased to be here today.
Well, we're glad to have you. So let's start by having you give us some definition as to land entitlements. What exactly are they?
Yeah, that's a very broad basket that we use, but that could cover anything as simple as getting a site plan approval, but it also could be something more comprehensive like getting a zone change or a general plan amendment. Or a complete change in use from, you know, commercial to residential or vice versa. So it's the basket of goods that you're granted by whatever governmental agency, county, city, state, municipality that you're dealing with that's going to provide you the right or the entitlement to go build a project. And so it's kind of a very broad terminology, but it includes all of those things.
Now, as a young reporter, sat through, I can't tell you the number of planning and zoning meetings I sat through as a young reporter, and, you know, one of the, and what I see, and we'll get into this a little bit later, is oftentimes there's pushback when people want to rezone property, but I'm assuming that when an investor goes in to buy a property, they have a rezoning, if the property is in need of rezoning, they're going to try to convert it to its highest and best use. They have somehow vetted the process to where they know, look, if I buy this property, my chances of getting it rezoned, I'm expecting that it's going to go through. Historically, the county or the city has rezoned for these purposes, and the adjacent land is also industrial, and I want to convert to industrial or residential or what have you. Is that the case? How much due diligence needs to be done ahead of time on a land purchase to know that the eventual change of zoning or some other entitlement is going to be forthcoming?
Well, that's a great question. The question of diligence, and not to dismiss what's done when buying an existing office building, because that's obviously still a very long and detailed process, but I'd say if your objective is to acquire a piece of land and ultimately change the use or get it, you know, get an approval to build something, that's generally a more comprehensive diligence process, and part of that diligence is you've got all your physical diligence. You know, do I have utilities? You know, do I have the easements that I need? Do I have access? Those are things that are fairly straightforward. You got to check the you know, geology. You've got to check soils and those things. But then you get into the bigger question is, you know, assuming that all this looks good, is the city going to let me do what I want to do here, and you know, what are the exactions they're going to get from me to do that? And typically, when a person is doing this, they're going to go and check what they're planning on doing with planning staff and likely with the elected officials to get a nod, a head nod that yeah, you're in the right realm here, or you know what, are you crazy? We would never consider that. And you know, sometimes you get that nod, but the nod is, hey, yeah, you'll get there, but it's still going to take you a very long time. And so you have to do specific site diligence, but then I think for the people that are really successful, you also have to do municipality diligence, which is you have to understand kind of what the track record is of the municipalities for granting these options and granting these changes. And you can have, in some municipalities we do business with, the staff might be very supportive, but the elected officials aren't, or vice versa. Obviously, you need the elected officials because you ultimately need a majority vote to make the change. But just having the elected officials absent staff support, that alone won't get you there, or it's going to get you there in a very long time frame. So, you know, vetting this both with the staff, going out and meeting with, you know, interested neighborhood groups, and then trying to meet with the elected officials prior to a closing or prior to committing to a purchase is generally, you know, strongly advised. And in fact, there are some municipalities that, you know, once you've made your application, you can't even go talk to the elected officials again. So you're kind of better get all your deal cut. Not that it's a deal, but, you know, make sure you've got your best crack at getting an approval for your project before you commit to move forward on a project. And a lot of times you'll see people use an option structure to kind of mitigate that risk, where they don't have to put up the full purchase price, but they put a part of the purchase price in an option deposit, and then they the balance comes in, you know, payments upon success or progress payments. So
now I remember. I'll tell you a quick little story because I'm leading somewhere with this. I'm thinking back to when I was a reporter in Central Arizona, and there was a guy who owned a piece of property. It was a residential piece of property. He lived on the property, a big piece of property. This was a series of big properties with homes on them, and it was served as kind of a green belt. And what he wanted to do was rezone his property for commercial use, because there was a guy who wanted to put an Italian restaurant on the property, and he was trying to rezone it for commercial because he knew he'd get a better sale price on it. So where I'm going with this is, how often is it sounded like you were alluding to this actually, Bill. How often is it that, look, I'd like to buy your property, but I don't want to buy it until I know that the zoning is in place, so I'd like you to rezone it, and then I'll buy it for this price? Or is it really always basically always at the level that you and others work at, always incumbent on the buyer to just buy the land and then do the entitlements themselves?
Oh, no, I think frequently you've got users that will approach a landowner and say, look, we'll tackle this if you'll get the zoning for us, or we'll tie the property up, but we won't close until such time as we have those approvals. So I think it works all ways. You know, certainly not uncommon for, you know, a restaurant user, for example, to say, look, as long as I can get my zoning to build my restaurant, you know, I'll buy or lease from you. And they go through the process, and once they're done, then the transaction gets culminated. So it's pretty typical, but, it takes multitude of forms and fashions, and it requires, you know, a fair amount of what I call dexterity and flexibility to craft a transaction structure that works for both the underlying landowner and the group that's trying to do the entitlements and make that investment. And so as long as you retain a degree of flexibility, hopefully you can come up with a structure that works for all parties. And sometimes that structure might even include a joint venture, where somebody like ourselves would have the idea for a new plan, and somebody else owns land that maybe they've owned for years, maybe it's agricultural land or something else, and they form a joint venture where the landowner puts the land in, we put the capital in to make the change plus the sweat equity, and then we share the profits somewhere along the line. And that's not atypical, too. We've done that structure a few times.
Interesting. So in the case I'm talking about, there was ferocious pushback against this guy because the neighbors didn't want all the traffic of a restaurant. So I'm wondering, how often do you see this happen where members of the Planning and Zoning Commission are on board with it, the requisite agencies are okay with it, and it looks like everything is going to go smoothly, but then once it's brought into public view at a planning and zoning meeting, suddenly there's a lot of people showing up protesting, saying, we don't want this, and it's not going to work for our area.
It certainly happens, and then I think one of two things happens. I think you have, some municipalities and some projects, you're going to get an approval in spite of the kind of neighborhood pushback. If it's a good project and well-deserving, the government officials and the elected officials are going to make that decision that it's for the greater good of the community. And even though there may be a loud outcry, they may go forward with it. And then you have the other case where, you know, they just don't have the desire to push back against their citizenry, no matter how minority the population might be that's being outspoken. But our business has gotten more sophisticated in the last, you know, decade. You know, I've really been doing this for most of my career on and off in different scales. And really in the last few years, with social media and other things, we've gotten very good at our public outreach, at trying to build a support base. It's always easier to get the opponents of a project mobilized than the supporters. And so we've really spent a lot of time and energy in the last few years, you know, developing that support base and making sure that people show up and they send letters in and they show up and we get video testimonials or we get them to show at public hearings. And so trying to counter the naysayers, you know, there are people out there, you know, everybody I think has heard of the word NIMBY, not in my backyard. I said we also fight the people that are called CAVES. That's citizens against virtually everything. There are people like that. They just don't want anything going on. What our view is, we try to not fight people, but we try to work to a mindful solution. And in most cases, we've been able to do that. I wouldn't say in every case, but in almost every case, we've been able to come up with a solution, a compromise, where we were able to build a project that was financially viable and fiscally prudent, and yet was mindful of the concerns of the neighbors. And I think that's the best plan is when we're not, you know, we don't want to steamroll over people, because ultimately they're our long-term neighbors forever. So.
You know, and I remember in line with what you just said, Bill, about lining up support, I remember in one case where it backfired, there was a developer in Sedona, Arizona, who actually bussed people in. He went and leased some buses, he brought them to the meeting, he packed the meeting room, and for whatever reason, the Yavapai County Board of Supervisors, and they did not like that show of force, and he got a lot of pushback on it, and they really threw some darts at him during that meeting, I remember. So occasionally that thing, obviously can backfire. What's been your experience in terms of when it comes to opposition? Obviously, as you were saying, you seek to line up support, but when opposition presents itself, where does it usually come from? Is it neighboring property owners, or are there some other factors involved?
No, it could just be global kind of neighborhood regional concerns. Traffic's a big concern here in California, and so, you know, development by virtue brings traffic, and it brings traffic. It also could alleviate traffic. The right development can reduce traffic, because people have to live someplace. So if we can put people closer to their jobs, then it actually might be solving traffic. So you've got to tell that story. I think it's getting out in the community. It's willing to take your bruises. And it's going and building rapport and relationship with people. We do our best to get out in the community, to talk to people, to explain what we want to do. Then we hear some feedback, and then we go back and say, okay, well, what if we did this? Would this be more manageable for you? And we work through the process with them, and over time, you know, by and large, I mean, so far we've been successful on every project that we've taken to a vote. For over 25 years actually doing that, some small projects early in my career. But in my very first project, I got turned down. And ever since then, I learned, a few lessons, and then ever since then, I've been successful. So it was good to learn. It was good to lose on the first one and get humbled and get a little smarter. And, you know, smarter was, you know, trying to understand where the votes are going to lie before you get to the meeting, not after the meeting. And also understand that you could lose at one body, but as long as you know you got the votes and support at the next body, that's okay. And we've in fact sometimes taken a no vote to get to the yes vote. So I think it's understanding the playing field, understanding who your opponents are, understanding who your supporters are, and then also making a project that's just for the good of the community. You know, if it's just good for me, the landowner, and I'm going to walk away with a bucket of money and that's why it's a good project. It's not a good project if that's the only answer. I've got to be solving some community need. I've got to be solving housing. I've got to be solving affordable housing. I've got to be doing something that enough people see as value to be able to bring that project into their neighborhood. And I think we've been successful doing this for decades, and hopefully we'll continue to do it, for as long as I'm in the career, and the people that I've trained and got in the business will continue to do that as well.
So under the entitlements rubric, I keep referring to zoning, but as you said at the top, there's a whole basket terminology that comes under entitlements. My notes here say general land designation, city agreements, and so on. What are some of the other mechanisms or potential tools that a land investor has under entitlements?
Well, I'm going to speak to California because that's where majority of my practice is, although not exclusively, but I'll use the local terminology. It'll somewhat translate. But, you have a general plan, which is the city designation for what something might be, and it gives kind of general categories. So the top order would be something that was zoned one thing and you wanted to do something completely different, you would be getting a general plan amendment. That's kind of the highest level and most challenging to do. But then you might go to where we've actually written our own zoning code for large-scale master plan projects, where we would write what's called a plan community or a specific plan text, and we would actually write our own zoning code specific to our site with lot guidelines and architectural guidelines and how much park should we have, and really building a community. We're writing that all into that specific zoning code for that specific plan. And then you're getting down into, site-specific, which is, my site plan or my architecture. So it goes from the highest of just getting, general uses all the way down to I want to build, a 400-unit apartment building, and this is what it's going to physically look like. And from this approval, I can actually go get building permits and go build my project. Then you go into state and federal regulatory approvals. Army Corps of Engineer, who handles wetlands, waters of the United States, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, which handles endangered species, and in California, the California Department of Fish and Game. We also have Regional Water Quality Control Board, which handles, things like runoffs and stormwater detention, as well as if there were any, soil contamination that has to be dealt with. So you could end up with a half a dozen agencies, maybe more, on any one property. So you've got to coordinate those and run through all those processes at one time. So it's I would say it's not my father's land use business. My father wasn't in the real estate business, but it wasn't your father's land use business. This business is very sophisticated. It requires a lot of professionals. On any given job, we probably have 10, 15 different consulting contracts, maybe more on some. We're doing traffic analysis. We're doing air quality. We're doing water quality.
Are those all part of the environmental impact report, Bill?
Those would all be part of an environmental impact report, which would have to be certified and be part of the process under which we would build. Today we have to analyze greenhouse gases. When I got in the career, I didn't even know what greenhouse gases were. I knew what they were because I'm a scientist, but by education, but it wasn't anything we paid any attention to for, running our real estate business.
Right. So the whole entitlement process, it's a long, winding, expensive process, and the operative objective is to increase land value. How do entitlements influence land values? What if you've got a piece of property you've invested in, what can be realized through the entitlement process? In terms of higher land value or being able to, the really land people get into the whole entitlement process because they're trying to boost the value.
You're trying to understand what it's going to be worth. So you have to say, okay, well, this is what I think could be on this site. You start with that as a vision of, you know, this site is this, or it's a blank slate. What can I put here? And then you've got to do market research, and you've got to determine, you know, what's the right product mix, what's the zoning allow, or what do you want to try to get it to allow, and we're mixing the product and the market in the municipality with all of those things in one. We do a very top down approach in our business. We start with, okay, here's what we think could go here. And then we start looking at specific products to come up with highest and best use, highest what we call land residual use, which is we get the not necessarily the highest density, but the highest value for that land. And that highest value for the land isn't necessarily highest density. As a matter of fact, I just left a conversation where we have the ability to put 225 units on the property, but we're only going to build about 140. Because we think the 140 will yield us more overall value than building the 220. So it's understanding that and kind of taking a very top-down approach from looking at the developer. Even if you're only going to be the land developer, you've got to understand the home builder or apartment developer or shopping center developer's his economics to create that highest land residual. So that you understand, you know, how am I going to create the most value for my land, whether I'm going to build it out or I'm going to sell it to somebody else. And so that's understanding what rents you'll get, what home prices you might get, and then what it costs to build that structure. So it's a soup to nuts knowledge base where you have to know everything from the land use stuff all the way to, you know, how much it costs you to build that particular product type and whether I'm building a single-family detached home or a three-story attached townhome. And those things build for different prices and understanding those costs and those densities and how they might yield different value. So it's fairly sophisticated. I'd say fairly being understatement. But I think it's something that if people make a great understanding of it and they get skilled at what they do, you can achieve, very interesting results financially and do tremendous things for the community. And I think a combination of those two is what makes this so rewarding for us.
Now, you have also spoken about agency or special permits. What are they?
Well, I might need an Army Corps 404 permit, which is required for if I impact what's called waters of the U.S., so wetlands or stream beds. And so if I'm going to encroach on that, do a bridge over it, do anything like that, I'm allowed a certain amount of impact to that where I can qualify for a nationwide permit. But I've still got to go get a permit, and I've still got to go consult. And then if there's any species in the area that are on the endangered list, then I might have to go do a consultation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife and do a Section 7 consultation with U.S. Fish and Wildlife. Or in California, I'm going to do a consultation with California Department of Fish and Game. So there's all these different, I could throw out all kinds of acronyms, and I'll try to spare your audience getting too many of those.
Thank you.
I could tell you when I came to California from Texas, the first couple of months I was out here, I kept my yellow pad, and in the margin I would write down the acronyms, and I would have to go ask people what they meant afterwards, because I didn't want to ask in the meeting, because I was the investor who took over projects for somebody who knew the local jargon, and I didn't want to be, you know, look like the dumb guy in the room. So there are no dumb people in the room, and, you know, we had to come up with understanding this over time. So
I'm sure the first acronym you learned was NIMBY, which you've already referenced earlier.
That one I've known, and you know we have others that we use. But like I said, my business has gotten more sophisticated, not only in my understanding of, you know, land use and land valuation, but, you know, how do we maximize it? How do you build it out? How do you maximize views? And, you know, so it's we've gotten more sophisticated. We sit on Google Earth and we can look at sites, but we still got to go out to the site and understand it and understand what the conditions are. And you know, we just got an entitlement on a site, and on one side we had industrial neighbors, and on the other side we had a railroad track. You know, how do we design our project to maximize value but minimize the impact of those conditions? And we came up with some good answers. We're very happy with the result, and I think the market's answering that they are happy with it. So it's really understanding it. It's a boots on the ground business. Get out there, understand what you're doing, understand what you think is rational. I think it's great to have a vision and have a dream. If you build it, they will come. But at the end of the day, what it is, if you build it and it's economically feasible, they'll come. So I got to temper that a little bit, but you got to have the vision. And you know what I tell people is my job is about making the invisible visible. It's about how do I go through my life and drive by properties that I've been driving by every day for years and figure out that's what should be there. And I'm going to tear that down and build something new, or that's vacant, never been built on, and it should be this. And then going out and figuring out how to execute that. And then ultimately, when you see it up and built, is when you know whether you accomplished your dream or not. So,
now, you have emphasized the professionalization of the real estate business and how much more sophisticated it is. There's no question about that. But when it comes to entitlements and using entitlements to permitting to increase land value or to optimize a project, is that something that do you still see it mishandled by a lot of developers out there, or are most people onto this stuff in a way that they actually are quite artful at doing it? Or are there still a lot of people who kind of stumble their way through it?
I would say, look, the people who are really in the business, they're understanding how to do it. They get it. There's a group of people who, think they know what they're doing, and they try and they fail and they wish they'd hired professionals. If it's a non-controversial deal, I would say, you can go pull this off on your own and, you can do it. But it's really, I think it really requires, being a pro and understanding how to get through this and mm-hmm. how to maximize value. Because if you don't really know what you're doing, you may be successful in getting the approval, but that approval might not have added any value to your asset. And so
ended up spending a bunch of money getting the approval.
Yeah, we frequently spend in the millions of dollars to get one of these projects approved. This is not small money. A million is like on the small end for the kind of things we're doing. It's not inexpensive to visualize a large-scale project and get it done. So if you're doing it, just make sure you're paying attention. There are good consultants out there, so you don't have to, you can bring people on to do aspects of it and still go realize your dream. Or you can team up with somebody and bring them in for a piece of the pie to help you be more successful.
So you have talked, final question, Bill, you have talked about some of the obstacles or pitfalls that a land investor or developer can face in the process. Are there any others that you would cite that you haven't touched on that other than failing to line up some support or not seeing clearly that there's some obvious opposition or not doing your due diligence ahead of time and meeting with the key city or county officials and making sure that you're on the right path? Are there any other potential pitfalls that people should know about?
Well, clearly you've got to start with the physical constraints of the property and making sure you've really vetted the property. You have good geology, do you have good drainage, do you have good basic site conditions to be able to do what you want to do, soils that aren't going to be too expensive to build on. And then you build up from there in each little issue. But no, I think it's every site's going to be a little bit unique, and you start with a basic game plan, and we have our basic strategy map that we use, but then we customize it for every different project that we do. And so far we've been successful in kind of outguessing the marketplace. at least staying ahead of what we think the problems are. But that doesn't mean we do it every time. We just, you know, just more often than not, we've been able to stay on top of things and you know, manage to, you know, be successful. So,
you know, actually, I do have one other question for you, and that is that we are looking at a correction coming up. There's the expectation that there's going to be a recession at some point. There always is. And real estate values are going to adjust to some degree. So given that, are you changing the way you're doing things at all? Or do you approach a project in a manner that you just figure, look, this is going to be financially fit enough that it will ride out a downturn, unless it's something really extraordinary is going to ride it out. It's going to be able to weather your typical storm. Or are you taking a more defensive approach to development and redevelopment?
We do not try to time, you know, highs and lows of the market, but we try to be mindful of where we think we are in a cycle. So we're, you know, today I would say we tend to look for not always, but mostly shorter duration opportunities, so we can get in and out, in a time frame I can see. I said, look, my crystal ball is very good if I'm trying to plan on what's going to happen in the next 5 minutes. The next 30 days a little bit better, and the further out in time, my crystal ball gets, you know, really cloudy, and so, you know, I either have to get paid more, and so if I've got a long duration asset that I'm considering today, and I will do those, I'm generally just going to buy them, you know, cheap enough to hold them through a cycle. And if I have a very long duration asset, you know, where I think my build out is going to be beyond the cycle time, you know, then again, I just have to buy that asset at a price that I can afford to sit back during a cycle. Because cycles are going to occur, and they're going to occur when you weren't planning them. If we could all plan for them, and look, there's some guys who are smart enough to get out before cycles. I got out of most of my stuff before the last cycle, but not all of it. And if you owned any, it was too painful. But, you know, it's nice just to be, you know, I think the bigger part of it, what we've learned at this point in our career, be properly capitalized to be able to manage the cycle risk.
Our guest has been Bill Schopoff, Chairman and CEO of Schopoff Realty Investments, and he's given us a lot to think about when it comes to entitlements and permitting with regard to land value and development. Bill, thank you for the time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.